Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to On the Ball with Rick Bucher. Here's your host.
Let's send it over to Rick Bucher.
Rick Bucher.
This is On the Ball on the United WeCast Network, and I am Rick Bucher. You can see me on FS1, hear me on Fox Sports Radio, and you can read me on the Fox Sports app and at foxsports.com. You can also follow me on X, the former Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Rick Bucher. I'm a lot of places, but there's only one place you can hear me talking about story angles and perspectives that you are not likely to find anywhere else, primarily but not exclusively involving the NBA, and that is here. So the NBA playoffs have begun, and while I felt like I had a fairly good handle on how the early matchups were going to go, there are always unforeseen variables dictating who wins and loses, so you never really know. I am often compelled by my work on TV, radio, and in writing to make predictions. I know fans like to suggest the quality of my analysis, or anybody's analysis, is defined by whether or not our predictions prove to be accurate. But I'm here to tell you that that's neither true for me nor my employers. What Fox Sports or anyone else I've worked for, ESPN, TNT, what they want is something bold, a bold statement backed up with interesting or convincing substantiation. What I pride myself on is identifying the factors that are going to determine a series, the strengths and weaknesses of the respective teams that fans should keep an eye on to fully appreciate the drama. I'm always thinking, what can I tell you that is going to make your viewing of the actual event more informed or more interesting? What am I going to give you that's going to cause you to watch the game in a slightly different way? That is my goal, ultimately. If what I say is going to happen doesn't happen, or does happen, generally, that's just outcome. I'm usually pretty good when it comes to this is how so-and-so is going to play, or this is what this team is going to try to do. And I feel as if I do that accurately, then I've done my job. Not perfect by any means, but that's what I strive for, just so you know. And it just so happens, my predictions for who's going to win the first round series are looking pretty promising as well, at least based on the results from the first weekend, which I'm now going to review and point out what we should take away from those first game ones to shape our expectations for the playoffs going forward. Let's start with the one I was most intrigued to see, Lakers versus Nuggets. I fell down that same rabbit hole of thinking, you know what, maybe the Lakers can make a series of this. I picked the Nuggets to win the series, but as I explained on TV, there was a sliver of hope for Lakers fans. And that sliver was their vastly improved ability to shoot the three over last year's team, along with Anthony Davis playing as well as I've ever seen him at both ends of the floor. Shooting the three at a torrid pace and AD being a force at both ends, which in my mind is essentially coming close to playing Jokic even, I felt had to happen for the Lakers to have a chance of winning game one. They don't have, if you look at the two rosters, they don't have a particular matchup they can exploit. And they're not better offensively or defensively overall. Again, it's amazing that we always come down to, and I saw the same thing happen last year, and I saw people predicting that the Lakers were going to win the series. And I think it's just sort of the LeBron Lakers mystique. It's the not looking like a championship team and then winning it in the bubble, not looking like a team that was going to get to the Western Conference Finals last year and then winding up there. I think that's what causes us to overrate their opportunities and ignoring the fact that they were playing the defending champions in the first round. We look for variables, myself included, to justify why we're giving the Lakers a chance, completely ignoring that the Denver Nuggets have won. We didn't ignore that they've beaten them 8 times in a row. But because those 4 times last year in the playoffs were all relatively close, looking for that little reason why it could flip the other direction, as opposed to fully acknowledging that Denver just has more. In any case, they don't have a particular matchup they can exploit. They're not better offensively or defensively overall. And I will say scouts and GMs have expressed skepticism to me about Denver's bench since the start of the season, having lost Bruce Brown and Jeff Green to free agency last summer, in terms of Denver's ability to repeat. And if there's one reason to question if the Nuggets can repeat, that's probably it. But that said, one, it's not going to be a factor, shouldn't be a factor in this series against the Lakers. That's not enough to flip it. And based on Bruce Brown's contributions in Indiana and Toronto this season, where he spent parts of it, I'm not sure the bar for replacing him is as high as those scouts might think. Yes, he averaged 12 points a game in last year's championship run. Yes, he hit some big shots along the way. But as long as Peyton Watson and Christian Brown don't turn the ball over and aren't afraid to take an open shot, which neither of them appears to be afraid of, then the Nuggets should get enough out of them to compensate for Brown and Green's absence. I wasn't particularly impressed with Brown's defense overall. It was his shot making, and he gave you an effort defensively, but his defense, I think, was reliant on the team as a whole as opposed to him individually doing anything. In any case, both Peyton and Christian are capable of being much better defenders. And with Nikola Jokic being more forceful scoring and Michael Porter Jr. having bumped up his production and Jamal Murray looking healthy, they should be covered on offense. I'm all for veteran presence and the value of that, but Jeff Green really didn't play much of a role last season. Not during the playoffs. Now, Watson and Brown didn't either, but they were on the roster, and they were around, and they played some minutes. They at least soaked in the atmosphere and got a feeling for what it's like to play in those kind of games. And Brown did have some moments in those series. And Mike Malone has had the entire year to prepare those two to play bigger roles in this year's attempt to repeat. And it's not as if Brown and Watson were flawless against the Lakers by any stretch. In fact, some of Watson's decisions did give me pause when he came into the game earlier than expected because of Aaron Gordon getting into foul trouble. Got beat on a backdoor cut by LeBron, which is just, you just have to be more awake on that. And then the second time, in not wanting to get beat on it, got locked up with LeBron, and LeBron was able to draw a foul. But did hit a couple of big threes. He was able to balance out sort of his mistakes on one end with some offense at the other. In any case, they were plenty, the Nuggets bench was plenty good enough against the Lakers, outscoring their subs 17-11 with all 11 points coming from Taurean Prince and matching them in rebounds with 10. DeAndre Jordan, who initially looked afraid to even look at the rim when he got early minutes, subbing in for Jokic, gave the Nuggets an unexpected boost with 4 points, including a pair of free throws, which is not something he's known for. And on the home court, the crowd, the feeling that they got, it was like, oh, this is found money. We're getting free throws from DeAndre Jordan. How can we lose? Anyway, he 4 points. I didn't check the rebounds, but I know he rebounded the ball. Had a block and a steal all in 8.5 minutes. That's a very productive 8.5 minutes, especially for DeAndre Jordan. The Lakers' three-point shooting and AD were indeed big factors for about the first 1.5 quarters. They made three of their first 6 threes, and then AD went repeatedly at Jokic, all resulting in a 12-point lead midway through the second quarter. The Lakers looked like they could play with Denver. It looked like what I suggested, the sliver, they were gonna slide through that sliver of an opening. But then the Nuggets reminded us that they have another gear to get to that the Lakers don't, that most teams in the league don't have. And they've done this throughout the season. It's cost them a couple games here and there, but for the most part, they know what they can get to, and they don't do it right out of the gate. But as soon as they feel like, okay, we need to impose what we're capable of doing, this, we don't want this game to get away from us, we need to go now, they can ratchet it up in an instant, which they did. That 12-point lead, midway through the second quarter, by the time we got to halftime, it was a 3-point lead. The Nuggets reminded us about that gear. Gordon got back into the game. Jamal Murray got a little more aggressive. Michael Porter Jr. found his range. And the Lakers lead was down to 3 by halftime. The Nuggets then flexed the full power of their starting 5 in the third quarter. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope joined the party. He made 4 of 5 threes. And this is what you get from a team that has won a championship and returns its first 5 intact. They're not worried about who's getting done what. They just play. And whoever's open, they know they're going to be in the right place. They know they're going to be taking shots that they can make. They know they're going to be defending the way they're supposed to defend. They have an understanding of how to harness their best when it is needed. Now, what I found most strange about the game, and maybe most distressing for at least some Lakers fans. I don't know what to make of Lakers fans these days. They're a little whinier than I've ever remembered them being. Maybe it's just, it's the struggle of thinking that you have stars, but not playing for championships the way Lakers teams normally do when they have stars. I don't know what it is, but I recently put out there that I had Anthony Davis on my Defensive Player of the Year ballot. Third, but on the ballot, and wanted to put him first, but just couldn't justify it. And in large part because Anthony Davis doesn't give you multiple efforts the way that Rudy Gobert and Bam Adebayo do, for two examples. And you would have thought that I said that Anthony Davis was the worst defensive player in the league, or that he shouldn't even be in the conversation. I don't know what set them off. Well, what set them off is the idea that he doesn't give you multiple efforts. Maybe they're used to watching LeBron not play hard. Maybe they're used to watching AD give you hustle plays. At times, yes, he does give you multiple efforts, but not consistently. And I thought that the reaction was so harsh. I went back and I said, you know what, let me watch game one, the beginning of game one again. Am I missing something? Is AD playing with an energy that I'm missing? And I couldn't, it was worse than I thought. The amount of time that he stands around and doesn't even make an effort to get involved in a play, both offensively and defensively, when it's for him or when it's coming at him, then yeah, you're going to see some energy. When he blocks a shot and he has a chance to block another shot, you're going to see energy. But consistently on every possession, no, you don't see that. And then I turned and I watched some Gobert, and I'm like, there's night and day in terms of the energy at both ends of the floor, but especially defensively between these two. What are we talking about? And Bam Adebayo, I don't have to explain that. If you've ever watched him, I don't know that his energy at the defensive end is ever, ever low. So, hate to digress, but it's kind of been sticking in my craw. Like, what's going on with Lakers fans? Your expectation for everybody to bow because what? They're wearing the purple and gold? I don't get it. AD was really, really good this year. I've said it. He's the only reason that they were mediocre defensively. I said it. I went out of my way to say it. And now I'm a bad guy because I point out the fact that he doesn't give you the multiple efforts that Rudy Gobert and Bam Adebayo give you, which is just, if you watch the games, if you just watch, that's the other thing that kills me. I got Lakers fans saying, you obviously don't watch the Lakers. No, your problem is I do. I don't go by box scores. I don't go by numbers. I don't want to hear the broadcast because that's propaganda half the time. I just watch. And a lot of times I go back and I watch again. That's your problem, is that I am watching and I am not deceived by what anyone or any box score tries to tell me. I know what good defense is. I know what effort is. I know what assignments they have and whose fault it is generally when something breaks down. That's the problem. You can't fool me. And maybe that's the issue that Lakers fans have, that I can't be fooled. Maybe. Anyway, what I found crazy in this game was how passive LeBron James was in the fourth quarter, with the game still kind of within striking distance. I mean, it was around double digits, but it wasn't big. It was 13, 11, 9. I think it got down to 6 at one time. But LeBron James had almost nothing to do with that. I also was struck by how exhausted Anthony Davis was until I looked. He played 44 minutes. So, okay. At the end, he was doing a Giannis Antetokounmpo at the free throw line, taking as much time as he could and taking long, deep breaths. Obviously, we know about the altitude in Denver. He even angrily flipped the ball back to the ref at one point when the ref bounced the ball to him sooner than he wanted it, which, by the way, is an interesting wrinkle. I don't know if Giannis pick up on this, but if you want to get around that 10-second rule, the 10 seconds doesn't start until the ball's in your hands. So you can hold off the referee, or you can even do what AD did and flip it back and pretend you're not ready. So look, again, I don't know if it was the altitude or the strain of having to be a force at both ends. He was doing a lot of work offensively, as he normally has to. He has to do a lot defensively, but again, like for the Lakers and for AD, he was working hard. It's just when you compare him to some of the other guys that are in the Defensive Player of the Year conversation that the level of effort is not quite the same. For the majority of players in the league, AD's energy and what he has to carry for the Lakers to be decent is admirable. So, and look, it was a complete performance. It was as much of a complete performance as you could hope for from AD. 44 minutes, team leading 32 points, 14 rebounds, 5 assists, and 4 blocked shots. As for LeBron, my first thought was, well, I guess he's preserving his box score line so that the casuals or his ardent fans could point to it and say that he did his part. If only he had received more help. We've heard that before, right? He was 10 for 16, 3 for 5 on three-pointers. And I'm sorry, but after seeing D'Angelo Russell miss 9 of his first 10 threes, with LeBron hitting 3 of his first 5, I'm looking to LeBron to take it upon himself not to continue to feed Russell. I would not blame LeBron. You're going to have to take my word on this. If instead of 10 for 16, he was 10 for 30. But damn it, he went after it. Like, I'm good with that. He's 39. I don't expect him to necessarily get it. I expect him to try. Maybe that's wrong on my part. But LeBron did not. He was hoping, or apparently expecting, D'Lo to get going. LeBron took exactly 2 shots in 9 fourth quarter minutes. and his one make was a meaningless layup with 35 seconds left and the Nuggets up by 13. He finished with a pristine 10 for 16 for 27 points, 6 rebounds, and 8 assists. That's a very nice box score if you look past the 7 turnovers. All of them live and more than half of them unforced. But years from now, or maybe even today, for those who only judge by numbers, the box score will suggest the supporting cast is what lost this game. Which is fair. What it won't tell you, though, is LeBron didn't try to win that game, which he didn't. All right, moving on. The Knicks outlasted the 76ers, as I anticipated that they would, with Tyrese Maxey not being quite ready to be that guy, or him, as we like to say these days, and Joel Embiid running out of gas late, which I, again, expected. He missed his last 5 shots. Got to the free throw line, hit some free throws, but wasn't the same player down the stretch. I can see the Sixers winning a game or two in this series, but I do not see them winning the series. The Knicks' chemistry is too good. Jalen Brunson is a legit closer. And they have the size to make Embiid work for everything he gets. And with a guy who is still coming back from missing 2 months of action, that's just too much to ask. I also believe that they're still trying to figure out the dynamic. During those two months, Tyrese Maxey got to be the main player, the guy that they played everything through. And now that Embiid is back, they naturally go back to Embiid. And so Tyrese, while they had this, they kind of looked like they had it figured out at the beginning of the year. They were doing it effectively, playing off of each other. It was still Embiid 1, Tyrese 2. And now, honestly, for where Embiid is, with Embiid back, it probably should be Tyrese 1, Embiid 2. But it's not going to be that way, or at least it wasn't in game 1. It's still going to be Embiid as the primary. Even though I fully expect that is going to leave him gassed in the fourth quarter. And I would expect that most of these games, if not all, are going to be decided in the fourth quarter. The Boston Celtics out-talented the Miami Heat. Absolutely no surprise there. But they in no way out-executed them. And Boston fans are going to take exception to this, but despite the convincing win, I saw the very things that make me doubt the Celtics can make good on having the league's best regular season record by being the first team to 16 wins in the postseason. They're still way too happy to just hoist threes. And there seems to be no rhyme or reason to how they play from quarter to quarter. They don't seem to play time and score. And what matchups they look to exploit or what they try to force the opponents to do, it just doesn't, there doesn't seem to be like an overarching theme or game plan. Now, I don't see them losing to the Heat this time around, but if they run up against a team with less of a talent disparity, which is how I describe half of the Western Conference teams in the playoffs, I think they're in trouble. All the teams I picked to win their series, by the way, Denver, New York, Cleveland, and Minnesota, won game 1 on the first day.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
all but the Knicks winning handily. And a big deal was made about Anthony Edwards outplaying and talking trash to the Suns' Kevin Durant. But the reason for the Timberwolves' blowout win was Rudy Gobert and Karl-Anthony Towns dominating Yusuf Nurkic. In fact, kind of playing him off the floor. Nurkic had a measly 4 rebounds in 26 minutes. And I know it's not chic these days to acknowledge that Gobert is tougher than any of the old heads currently on TV like to admit, which is a prejudice toward Euro bigs in general and Western Euro bigs in particular that was alive and well when the old heads were playing, that they're soft. And it's a prejudice arguably even justified, or at least it was then, but not now. First of all, the league in its entirety is much softer. American bigs are much, 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 much softer. And this whole narrative that he's afraid to step out and defend on the perimeter isn't backed up by the tape. Like, he will get out there. He'll move his feet. He's fairly agile. And trust me, fans aren't the only ones saying this. I've heard this from people in the business. I've even heard it in terms of the Timberwolves. Some of their personnel have suggested, yeah, it's something we have to be conscious of. Okay, I'd like to see some help when he's out in this game one. He's defending Devin Booker, trying to trap him in the corner. Devin Booker turns the corner on him. He chases him, and nobody steps up. There's nobody even in the frame. And so Devin's able to wisely use the rim as a protector and hits a little reverse layup and scores. I don't know how much more you want from a 7-footer guarding someone as good and quick as Devin Booker with his handle on the perimeter. He gave you effort. He made it a tough shot. That to me is, I mean, maybe we'll see some other teams with some other matchups, but as long as Gobert is giving me that effort and showing me that he can move a little bit, it's not like they're blowing by him and guys are crushing dunks. So we'll see how it... I may be proved wrong going forward. But Gobert being able to step out or being willing to step out, I'm not convinced that that's going to stand in the way of the Minnesota Timberwolves, or is going to be the reason that they get knocked out. And in any case, the whole narrative around Gobert being soft, and I think that's a total misnomer. He started out game one against the Suns guarding Kevin Durant, picking him up well beyond the three-point line. And it's why and forced him into two mid-range jumpers, both contested. KD made one, he missed the other. I think that Gobert actually could use his length more than he does, so that he doesn't have to rely on his feet and agility as much. I almost feel as if he's trying to prove a point. But I just don't get the feeling that he's not a mobile big. And if you ask me who was tougher between Anthony Davis and Gobert, I'm going with Rudy Gobert. I'd really be interested if that was posed to some of the old heads, former players, if they were asked to make that comparison. It would put him in a very uncomfortable position. And if you ask me who is in better shape, again, I'm going with Gobert over Anthony Davis. There were two game ones that were decided by double digits, but were nevertheless not convincing wins in my mind. The first was the Clippers' 109-97 win over the Dallas Mavericks. The Clippers, as you've probably heard me say, are as big of a front-running team as you will find. So when they're rolling, they can really roll. When they have a big lead, man, they can catch fire. But as soon as the competition gets a little intense, a little challenging, as soon as they have a string of shots that don't fall, or the calls don't go their way, they can also shrivel in a hurry. They blew a 21-point lead against the Lakers and a 13-point fourth-quarter lead against the Bucks without Giannis Antetokounmpo. It's also if they enjoy the least bit of success, they are all too quick to downshift. So we'll not be surprised if they don't give the same performance in game two. The problem is, when it comes to the end of games, is that they don't have great off-the-ball players. So through the course of a game, they can be tough because so many different guys can go one-on-one and score. But in the final minutes of a close game, it generally becomes predictable who is going to have the ball. It's going to be Paul George or James Harden, with Kawhi Leonard out. And neither one of them is likely, nor is Kawhi. None of them are likely to pass without burning up a lot of clock first and going to every length to find their own shot. They're not going to give up the ball and get it back in a better position, which is what the truly elite players and teams do. It's what had made the Warriors so lethal in their heyday, with both Steph and Klay. Watch how Jokic and Jamal Murray operate. They happily give up the ball and utilize a screen to get the ball back in a better position with their defender now trying to get reattached to them, and all the angles, where they are on the floor, everything behind that defender, everything's changed. So he's got to, it's not static. He's got to get comfortable again with where everybody is and the angles that he's trying to shut down. The Clippers, conversely, are consistently static at the end of games, and it makes it infinitely easier to guard them. The short of it is, in spite of the Clippers' double-digit win in Game 1, I still expect the Mavs not only to make it a series, but I expect them to win it. The second game that was a win was a big margin win, but not a convincing win in my mind, was the Milwaukee Bucks beating the Indiana Pacers without Giannis Antetokounmpo. I had a feeling that Damian Lillard might take all the doubts about him personally and show out in Game 1, this being familiar territory, having to carry an underdog team. And no surprise, he was spectacular as the Bucks built a 27-point halftime lead. But this had a lot to do with the Pacers' collective lack of postseason experience. It took them a full half to find their offensive rhythm and play fast, but not too fast. They came out in the third quarter and chopped the Bucks' lead in half and had a chance to make it a single-digit game going into the fourth quarter, which would assuredly put a chill through the Bucks on their home floor if that had happened. Now, I like Lillard's chances of still getting out a win had it come down to a back-and-forth game. But Milwaukee's inability to shut opponents down, which we've seen all year long, and faced with the most explosive offense in the league in the Pacers, is why I still see Indy as a legitimate threat to win both Game 2 and the series. The difference between the regular season and the playoffs could not have been more apparent than in the Thunder-Pelicans game. The Thunder's vulnerability because of a lack of size was on full display. And I've mentioned it before, but the drop-off in size after Chet Holmgren is pretty severe. They also don't run a very complicated offense, all of which makes them fairly easy to dissect and game plan for. On the Pelican side of things, we're just seeing once again that they don't really have a top-notch go-to scorer. If you're asking why, for all those weaknesses or vulnerabilities that the Thunder has, why didn't the Pelicans exploit it? Well, Brandon Ingram is good, but it takes him a lot of dribbles and time to get to his spots. And he, for the most part, is a mid-range. Mid-range is where he lives. He's not finishing the rim a whole lot. Three-point shot kind of comes and goes. He's going to try to get to that mid-range, and that's where he's going to score, on a pull-up off the dribble. CJ McCollum is pretty good at getting himself open for someone of his size and speed, but it feels as if every time I've seen him take a crucial shot the last 2 years in New Orleans, it just misses. It just rims out. It just doesn't bring home the game. And that's a problem, because I don't know who else you're going to turn to. And no, this is not a result of Zion Williamson being out. And no, I don't expect him back for this series, no matter how long it goes. Maybe if it's gets to a game six or a game seven, but Zion has to be 100%. He has to be able to go full throttle for him to be effective. He doesn't have a mid-post or off the elbow, I got a step back jumper, so you can just feed me here and I can use my passing ability and I can be a shot, I can be a scoring threat from here. He has to be able to face up and he has to be able to go 100 miles an hour, ideally to try to get enough space to finish with his left hand. Because every once in a blue moon, he'll put it up with his right. But the first, for the most part, whether he's going left or right, he's trying to finish with that left. Last but not least, there was the Cleveland Cavaliers handling the Orlando Magic. It would be easy to blame the loss on Orlando's lack of playoff experience, but I didn't really see that. I didn't see them out of sorts the way that I saw Indiana. I just saw what Donovan Mitchell for the Cavs has been doing since he was with the Utah Jazz, dominating round one opponents. The Magic aren't built to face two dynamic scoring guards because they only have one Jalen Suggs. And that's what the Cavs have in Mitchell and Darius Garland. I hope the Magic win a game or two because it would be great for the growth of Franz Wagner and Suggs and Paolo Banchero. But let's face it, they've already been massive overachievers this season. Getting ratcheted up to the level necessary to win in the postseason, well, they just got their first taste of what that might actually be without getting a full bite. And I will be very interested to see what kind of adjustments Jamal Mosley, the Magic head coach, makes going into game two. He was given a ton of credit for the Magic's surprise success, as young coaches often do when teams surprise us with how good they are. But this in the playoffs is where we truly find out what a coach is made of, because he's given ample time to prepare for the same opponent. The opposing coaches also has that ample time to approach to prepare for his team. We get a glimpse of just how capable coaches and teams are in such situations during the regular season, now that playing the same opponent in back-to-back games has become a regular part of the schedule. But it's not quite the same. The Magic did it four times, three times against non-playoff teams, once against the Celtics. They swept the two-game matchup against the lottery teams, and they lost both games to Boston. But even during the regular season, there are variables that intrude. Other upcoming games can influence how a coach utilizes his rotation. Both teams rarely are on the same schedule or have the same time off before or after the matchups. So rarely are they going to be approaching that two-game series the same way. Playoffs are completely different. It's both coaches with both with the same set of tools, the same schedule, the same ability to kind of really parse what the other team is doing and what his team is doing and figure out, how do I win this? Now, in a matchup of lopsided talent, such variables may not be enough to influence the outcome, whether it's certainly not in the regular season and sometimes not in the playoffs. But the beauty of the playoffs is the variables of schedule and rest and outside events are all erased. And for the most part, you're going to get teams where the talent disparity isn't so great that it is going to determine the outcome. It still comes down to execution. We get to find out not just who really is better than whom, but who plays the game better than whom. I think that's proper English. I don't think my 10th grade literature teacher, Mrs. Gravely, Mrs. Lillian Gravely, will be coming after me for that. Whether she will be or she won't, that's it for this episode of On the Ball on the United WeCast Network. Please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Obviously, we're going into game twos, and they're going to come fast and furious now. I'm not going to put out a podcast after every round of games, but I will try to put out several during each series. That's the best I can offer you. Schedule might be a little varied, but should be more frequent than it has been over the course of the regular season. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.